Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. Samara Cohn is, wow, what a career she has. Chief Investment Officer of ETF and Index Investments for BlackRock, the investing giant that manages $10 trillion. She's responsible for about $6.6 trillion of that. She sits on the BlackRock Global Markets Executive Committee. She leads a team of portfolio managers and traders and platform architects and market structure developers. Really a unique insight into how markets operate, how money flows, what investors are looking for. Just an absolutely fascinating set of positions at the largest investing firm in the world. I found our conversation about passive versus active, about the Bitcoin ETF, and about changes in market structure really to be absolutely intriguing. With no further ado, my discussion with BlackRock's Samara Cohn.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here in person with you, Barry.
Yes, it's great to have you. So last time, we went pretty in-depth into your background and education. You have a BS in economics from Wharton and a BA in theater arts from their College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania. As a refresher, how do you go from theater to finance? What's the relationship?
Well, I started with theater, as you said, because when I was in high school, I loved it, and now I am the parent of two high schoolers, Barry. So I think back to how important it was to me to go all in on something that I loved, and that's my hope for them, that they find something they're passionate about. For me, it was theater, not film, not entertainment. It was bringing people together in a live way in an audience to have some sort of experience that would maybe change them a little bit. And that's
big theater nerd.
Total big theater nerd, right. And so I went to college wanting to pursue that as a major. Now in high school, I was also very good at math, but it didn't feel like something I loved, but it was something I was good at. But when I got to college, I had all of this credit so that I didn't need to take another math class. And to my surprise, I found that I missed it. So I discovered economics. I heard about a professor. He was supposed to be good and felt like learning about markets and economics felt like math with purpose to me. And so I started pursuing that in parallel. That made my parents really happy, of course, because I was spending my summers working for regional theater companies. So they felt secure in the idea that I had a backup plan. And I felt like I got to live in these two different worlds, which really kind of widened my aperture on lots of things. And then when it was time to graduate, I wanted to take my backup plan out for a test drive and make some money so that I could support myself and be financially independent. And I found that I really loved markets.
Huh, that's really interesting. I'm kind of intrigued by something you told Fortune magazine not too long ago. 90% of directing is casting. Right? Fascinating conversation. Lots of film directors have said similar things to that. And the world has changed so much that they're even now adding a casting director, Oscar, which amazingly hasn't existed for years. But I'm curious how you think of casting in the job you have now, where you're managing so many different teams and so many different people. Is 95% of index management casting?
I think 95% of leadership, Barry, is putting the right person in the right job and assembling teams that build trust and can work together and maximize their individual strengths. So I guess what felt so specific to theater to me when I was doing it, and especially when I was directing, now feels like a pretty profound lesson in leadership.
It's less a specific idea to theater and instead is really a very broad principle.
I think it's absolutely true. Look, when you're a leader, your job is to make the most, to get the most out of people and organizations. It's not what you yourself can do. It's how you position other people to do their best work. That's pretty much what casting is.
So you mentioned you spend summers doing regional theater. There's a lot of technical work that goes into that, direction, lighting design, set design. There's just a ton of background work that goes to staging a show. What parallels can we draw to asset management? How much of the daily block and tackling that goes into putting on a show, it goes on to managing assets?
So I've often been asked about the theater part of my background. I've never been asked that question, so thank you, because I love bringing back those memories of being in theater, being in tech week of a show. And I would start by saying there's lots of different types of theater, and there's lots of different types of asset management. So the place that has the most relevant parallel for me was putting on large-scale musical productions during theater festivals where you had multiple stages going at the same time. In the business that I'm in right now, which is the ETF business at BlackRock, I would say that work is similarly orchestral. We like to say it takes an ecosystem for our ETFs to really deliver to investors, which means really being sensitized to all of the different places, how they work together, and how they work together, especially during moments of high velocity in markets.
So let's talk about a moment of high velocity. We're recording this 2024. 2022 was one of those years where velocity picked up, volatility picked up. It was a big negative for equities. It was a double-digit loser for fixed income. Unusual, both of those in one year. How did ETFs hold up, and what did we learn in that rough year of 2022 about the ETF complex?
Well, as you said, 2022 was a remarkable year for markets around the world because we had declines in both equity markets and bond markets. It was the worst bond market in 50 years. I will say, as someone who has really had the bulk of my career in the bond market, markets overall, and the bond market in particular, are much more resilient, transparent, and accessible today because ETFs are in them. So ETFs have contributed in a very important way to market structure growth and development. And what we saw in 2022 is first, a lot of really important portfolio reallocation decisions being made. All of a sudden, investors really had to think the role of bonds in their portfolio, how they were going to position for higher interest rates, what inflation would actually look like, what was the meaning of this new regime. And the first place that they turned to do this was often ETFs. So we saw ETF trading pick up, and that's not flows, that's just people using ETFs, buyers and sellers, to manage their risk and reallocate their portfolios. And we did also see ETF inflows, particularly in fixed income ETFs. So fixed income ETFs gathered really over $200 billion in 2022. And the reason for that is the bond market has historically really lacked transparency and been harder to access for individual investors who all of a sudden were realizing they probably needed a much more significant allocation to fixed income than they'd had before. So they turned to ETFs.
You know, it's funny we're talking about this now looking back at 2022. When you and I spoke in the spring of 2022, we talked about the volatility of 2020, and you pointed out ETFs held up splendidly. If anything, there were certain stocks that were halted. Other parts of the market had structural issues. ETFs came through that with flying colors. Is that a fair statement?
That's exactly right. And during these stressed markets, high velocity markets, investors need some outlet for risk management and for transparency. And so if ETFs have matured in the market, which has been over the past 30 years in the U.S., it has actually improved markets broadly.
So you mentioned flows. I think people assume there are flows into a particular fund and the prices go up. But that it's not always correlated that easily. What we saw into the rally in 2023 were outflows, and the market went up regardless. How do you at BlackRock and you overseeing all these ETFs think about the role of money flows into and out of various funds and what it might mean for the health of those funds and the subsequent performance of those funds and the market.
Well, across the ETF complex, as you pointed out, there are, you know, at iShares, we have 1,300 different ETFs. So being able to provide ways for investors to quickly change their exposures, move out of one fund into another fund, it's a healthy thing for markets. It's a healthy thing for portfolios. I don't know if your question is more around the role of ETFs and price formation and markets.
Just generally. So, you know, I'm always astonished when I flip on the TV and I hear someone say, oh, there are a lot of out funds from mutual funds and ETFs. That bodes poorly for the market. We saw outflows pretty much right into the from the lows in 2022 in October straight up to the, you know, recent highs. It's only recently they started turning positive. It seems like people are drawing the wrong conclusion by tracking flows. I don't know if I'm getting into the weeds too much. This is too much arcana. It just seems that whenever I hear people discuss flows, the context doesn't always tell the full story.
I think that's right with respect to direction of markets. Now, we actually love talking about our investment strategists actually have a piece that they publish called Flow and Tell, where they look to flows, which give lots of different types of information, but not necessarily directional information. So one of the things about ETFs is because they are trading intraday, they're super transparent, they're measurable on exchange, they actually give us some pretty useful measures around investor sentiment, also around positioning, around allocation decisions. And so there is lots of information that can be extracted from the transparency and availability of fund flow data, particularly with ETFs. But to your point, that doesn't necessarily translate into direction of markets. And just as an example, there's a statistic that I love to look at. We call it the imputed flow statistic, which mm-hmm. tells you how much flow into or out of ETFs was present in a particular stock. And if I look across the entire U.S. stock market, that statistic is usually about 5 or 6%. It actually goes down during times of market stress, that there's actually less market flow attributable to ETFs. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of other things going on with respect to price formation. But there are really important, I think, sentiment conclusions you can draw from, you know, flow and tell type data.
I love that name, flow and tell.
You should use it.
Sentiment is obvious. I think if you suddenly see people selling value funds and flowing into anything that's tech heavy, clearly there's been a shift in investor sentiment when that happens. What other data points do you look at in flow and tell that might surprise people?
Definitely asset allocation decisions. Mm-hmm. So how people are shifting portfolios around.
Is that from stocks to bonds or is it even within the equity market, what sectors are dominating?
It can be from stocks to bonds, and it also can be very interestingly within the fixed income complex. And that's been important, particularly lately, given kind of all of the focus and, you know, potential surprises coming out of the Fed and direction of monetary policy. So you've seen a lot of kind of implicit curve positioning happening across the fixed income ETF complex.
So since the last time we spoke 2 years ago, the ETF space has definitely evolved. What do you see as some of the bigger changes since we last spoke?
So I feel like, Barry, if you have me back in 2 years, I'm probably going to say the last 2 years have been the most, you know, exciting
right.
years
we'll
in
talk
ETFs,
about. Remember so. That volatility right after we had the recording?
Exactly. 2 years ago. But the point is, this has been a fast-moving stream. A lot has been happening in the ETF space and in markets. What I would say to me has really defined the last 2 years since we spoke are two things, and they're both really exciting. The first is the move that we are seeing around the world with what we call self-directed investors, mm-hmm. but more and more savers becoming investors. And we can measure that. Globally, there were about 40 million individual investor accounts that have been open in the last 2 years. That's more than the past decade combined.
Wow.
40 million individual investors coming to the market. Now, when I say, and I will say this everywhere, markets are better today, it's because to me, a healthy capital marketplace is one that has the transparency, resilience, and agility to bring more people off the sidelines so that they can save for retirement or whatever financial wellness looks like to them. So that's theme number one. And the second one is the ongoing convergence between index and active. Mm-hmm. And you will never hear me use the word passive, Barry. In fact, if I ever have my own podcast, it's going to be called There Is Nothing Passive About ETF and Index Investing, because we've really obliterated that concept. There are so many different types of strategies and outcomes that are available now through index strategies, which investors buy through ETFs, that it gives them, again, much more agility with respect to their portfolios and their goals.
And even the S&P 500 is, there are a lot of active decisions. It's market cap weighted. That's a choice. There are rules that determine who can and can't be in there. Companies get added and subtracted all the time. There's a decent amount of active within passive, but I want to come back to the 40 million new accounts. When I think of new accounts, I kind of harken back to 2020 and the pandemic lockdown and all the kids playing on Robinhood and that sort of stuff. Are these small fun accounts, or are these people really saving for things like paying for college or retirement or buying a home? Like, when, what are those, the constitution of these 40 million new accounts?
I think it's both of those things. So when people had their stimulus checks and there was commission-free trading, and to your point, they were home and learning about all of the things they could do with technology, maybe some people got involved more to just check out the ecosystem and what it felt like. But when you look at the data, despite all of the headline excitement that meme stock mania generated, more people were actually buying ETFs than were buying meme stocks. So I think it has been a really important moment for investors who are coming into the market and coming in maybe because they're starting with a single stock decision, but actually moving and learning about ETFs and then participating in a more diversified and long-term way.
I would like to see the Flow and Tell piece that looks at potential investors looking at some of the crazy meme stocks and saying, you know what, I'm just going to buy a broad index and put it away for a few decades and not get sucked into this mania. Do you guys track that closely?
We do. We do track it closely. And a few people have done really interesting work, particularly NASDAQ has done some interesting work on individual stocks versus allocations to ETFs and to index. And this trend that we're talking about, the individual investor trend, is absolutely across the market. We've seen it in options as well, which is why ETFs that have some sort of embedded options outcome are also seeing a lot of interest, particularly from the self-directed investors.
Really, really intriguing.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
So let's talk a little bit about some interesting news. Recently, low-cost index ETFs and mutual funds now make up more than 50% of the fund complex. Put a flag in the ground and declare victory. Does this mean that it's the end of active? Is there a ceiling for passive? What does that 50% line mean?
First of all, Barry, I am a huge fan of active managers and what they can achieve. Mm-hmm. My disclosure here will be that I'm married to a brilliant active manager. So I like to say that we are an alpha-beta couple. But increasingly, active managers have beta allocations. They always have, of course. Mm-hmm. They might use S&P futures, for example, as part of their strategies. And increasingly, really all of the biggest active asset managers in the world use ETFs for some part of their alpha-seeking strategy. So let's look at two things. Number one, the statistics that you gave, which is really about the fund market. It's important to realize that what is available through an index strategy has evolved massively over the past few years. So we're really not just talking about traditional cap-weighted strategies, which are kind of what you would get in a futures-type strategy, like with, you know, Russell 2 or S&P 500. There are factor strategies. There are an increasingly diverse range of bond market strategies across the different sub-asset classes of fixed income. So increasingly, for us, we like to think of that whole new genre of index ETFs as almost active risk benchmark. Anything that's not cap-weighted represents a decision by the investor to take some active risk versus the standard cap-weighted benchmark. So that's why I really think of index and active as a really broad continuum, with index being able to take on more and more types of strategies that, importantly, were never accessible to individual investors before. And that's why I maintain that today's markets, as a function of index and ETF technology, are simply better because they're more accessible, and diversification and more sophisticated strategies, for example, like target date funds for the 57 million Americans that actually don't have a workplace savings account, they can now, through an ETF, access target date investing, where they basically make one decision, which is, when do I think I'm going to retire? And then they can allocate to the ETF, and the ETF will manage their risk exposure.
Their stock bond proportion over time,
exactly.
It automatically adjusts it. And since it's an ETF wrapper, there's no capital gains to pay until you finally cash that in.
So it's a victory for investors, and it's a victory for those, you know, millions of people who are moving from being savers to investors, which is incredibly important in today's world as we think about, you know, retirement and people being able to retire with dignity. And then the other important part of your question, though, and I know you agree with me on this because I've heard you talk about it, is we have to look at the equity market overall.
Right.
So that 50% stat, you know, is a little bit misleading with respect to the denominator. ETFs are probably about 12 or 13% of the equity market, not 50%. And that gets back to these questions about, is there a ceiling? Like, there is mostly active management happening in price formation in global equity markets.
The broadest interpretation of passive indexing that I've seen is, of the total equity market, about 17% can be described as managed through a broad index, not active stock selection. People have argued that, well, you can look at flows, and foundations and sovereign wealth funds are managing stuff passively, quote unquote. But some of the numbers, 35, 40%, seem kind of fabricated. You want to say it's 20%, okay, back of the envelope, we can pretend. But there's just no data, no evidence showing that it's even that big. And when we look at, we can add up what's in ETFs, we can add up what's in mutual funds, and it's a relatively small part of the total asset management world, unless you think I'm overstating this.
I think you're exactly right. And I think additionally, if we agree that as a gut check, 20% of the equity market is indexed, right? ETFs or otherwise, it's important to remember that that is often by active managers who have beta as some component of their alpha seeking strategy. So their decision to make a beta allocation through some sort of index strategy is an active one, and is part of the, you know, broader setup of their portfolio. And potentially, given the technology and you know, indexing has risen alongside computing power, it actually required the first kind of commercial microchip came about around the same time as index investing, because you needed computing power to be able to do that. And now that asset managers can make beta allocations, they can focus their attention and resources on their highest conviction single stock or bond opportunities.
And let's put a little flesh on that, because I don't know if lay people are aware of how fund managers behave. You're running a concentrated portfolio, you have 30 or 40 stocks, and suddenly this stock generates a sell signal and you remove it from your portfolio, and that stock gets taken over by another company and it's achieved 99% of your price target. Now suddenly you have a 5 or 10% slug of cash, which if it's sitting around in cash, you're going to be underperforming an upmarket. So instead, you turn around and say, my benchmark is this. Here's the ETF that tracks that. I'm going to park this cash here so I don't fall behind my benchmark. And when I'm ready to actively select a replacement for these stocks, I'll swap out of one to another. Again, fair description of how it works in the real world?
Totally fair description, but I would say it's a relatively modern one because even 5 years ago, those managers might buy futures instead of ETFs. And what we found when we engaged with a lot of them, one of the things we did was we built technology to help asset managers evaluate the relative value between an ETF and a futures contract. It really mattered what they were earning on their cash. You had to be earning something in order to make it worth the price of the futures. Otherwise, the ETF looked quite cheap. And as it turned out, remember where rates were 5 years ago.
Right.
It was much more economic for them to move into the ETF. So using the ETF for the cash equitization has become a really standard active use of an ETF strategy, but it is a more modern one.
So let's talk a little bit about, you've mentioned market structure, and we're talking about active versus passive. Last month, I had hedge fund manager David Einhorn of Greenlight Capital on, and he said, I view the markets as fundamentally broken. Passive investors have no opinion about value. They're going to assume everybody else has done the work. Caused a big stir. Everybody kind of freaked out about it a little bit. But it raises the question, what has been the impact of this shift towards indexing and passive investing, I know you don't love that word, on overall market structure and the resiliency of our modern market economy?
Markets are more transparent and resilient as a result of ETFs being in them than they have ever been in history, Barry. And I reject the notion that a transparent, resilient, and more accessible market, again, look at these 40 million investors that are coming into the market and are only able to do it through diversified strategies because of ETFs and index. I reject the notion that there's anything broken about that. That is a healthy market, and that is a market that is better positioned for the next decade of growth than ever before.
So let's talk a little bit about index and ETF technology. What is it specifically about that approach, that wrapper around a stock investment that provides transparency and resiliency? How is this different than the way we used to manage assets 20, 30 years ago?
Well, first, ETFs are literally transparent. You always can see what's in the holdings of a particular ETF that's available on a daily basis. But even more critically, ETFs trade on exchange all day long and provide price formation in that way. So one of the things we often see, for example, in country fund ETFs, a perfect example of it is looking at ETFs with China equities underlying them over the Lunar New Year. They are providing price formation by trading on stock exchanges so investors can exchange risk on exchange while those underlying equity markets are actually closed. The bond market, by the way, you probably know this, I'm a bond market veteran. Like, the bond market has a lot of closure days where equity markets aren't open.
Right.
So bond ETFs are providing a price transparency to fixed income markets all of the time. And we really saw that profoundly over the COVID volatility period, where bonds, because you know the bond market had largely traded and you know still trades, big parts of the bond market trade in a very bilateral voice over telephone way, and these traders were literally packing up their desks and having to go home and reconstruct their workstations at home. And so there were days where if you took an investment grade ETF, its top 10 holdings might trade 35 times in the day in the bond market. We can see that through trace reporting, while the ETF itself traded 90,000 times.
Right.
So that's an example of real-time price formation that just wasn't available in the bond market before the ETF.
I think a lot of lay people don't realize the Russell 5000 is, what, 3,400 stocks today? There are millions and millions of CUSIPs of specific bonds, different credit ratings, different vintages. Every municipality has a run of bonds, every state, every city. There are tons of bonds, hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of bonds. So pricing is opaque and it's not always current. That's not true on the fixed income side for ETFs. It's all day long, and you get a price whenever you look at the ETF.
Yeah, so that's totally true. But one of the things that gets me super excited, because I am just a career markets modernizer, is that there's been a virtuous cycle and effect back on the bond market. Because investors have really demanded and wanted to participate in fixed income ETFs, bond dealers and trading desks have had to develop algorithmic pricing capabilities so that they could make markets in those ETFs. And that has had the effect of increasing electronification and transparency in the underlying bond market, which is why, again, there's been this, you know, introduction of ETFs as a new bond tool has actually had an important modernizing effect on that underlying market ecosystem.
So you guys have been one of the larger bond fund managers over years. And in old Wall Street, there were hundreds of shops that were managing individual bond portfolios. What's it like when you want to put together a bond ETF? I would imagine your desk has to revert to some form of old school, you know, picking up the phone and, hey, who has these bonds? We're a buyer. What can you get us? How do you marry the old with the new? How do you marry the phone with the algorithm?
Well, one of the things we talked about before are the challenges of cash management in a portfolio. And certainly in a bond market portfolio, that's a challenge for a manager who doesn't want to underperform the benchmark, but has to put...
Especially when you have some yield these days.
That's right, who has to put cash to work. Now, one of the most exciting aspects of the ETF innovation is the fact that portfolio managers of ETFs don't have to manage the cash. They can if they want to, but they can also do what we call in-kind trades with the street or with liquidity providers. So first, if people are buying the ETF, number one difference, just to take a step back, is that you can go and buy the ETF on exchange through your brokerage account. You don't have to write a check and send it into a mutual fund company. You are buying the ETF on exchange. Somebody is selling it to you. And if they have the seller on the other side, then there's nothing that the portfolio manager has to
right.
do. The buyers and sellers match off on exchange. And that's important because on average, it's about 6 to 8 times as much trading happens on exchange as in the actual ETF. But let's say that there is an imbalance of demand. More people want to buy that ETF than sell that ETF. So we start to see the price of the ETF actually, we traded a little bit of a premium to those underlying bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So then what the market maker can do is create more ETF shares to meet that demand by buying the underlying bonds, delivering it to me. I will be the portfolio manager in this case,
mm-hmm.
and then we give you the ETF shares. So I don't have to put the cash to work. The market has done that for me. They've been incentivized to do that because this market maker, she has captured the arbitrage spread that was available, and I didn't have to incur transaction cost drag for the shareholders in my fund. So that's one of the mechanisms that have made ETFs deliver so effectively for investors.
So let's talk about who are the holders of ETFs. How granular can you get in identifying here's who owns our ETFs for this fixed income product, this equity product? As a mutual fund company, you know exactly who owns that fund. Is it the same thing with ETFs, or is it a little fuzzier?
It's a little bit harder with ETFs, but our ability to capture and analyze data, just as there's much more information on everything, even if it's just looking at the nature of prints on exchange, we are able to derive much more data to make assumptions and really educated guesses about who owns the ETFs. And increasingly, we actually do have end user information. So a really important and exciting announcement we made, and we're the first to do this, is to, in our S&P 500 ETF, to, for certain investors, individual investors, give them the ability to decide if they want to vote their shares. Mm. And that's been a really important dialogue in the market, because as an asset manager, we don't own the shares. But for our ETFs, often the laws say we need to vote the share. But our job is to be asset managers. And so if clients want us to vote their shares for them, we can. But we prefer, and with our institutional clients, we give them voting choice. So they can tell us, BlackRock, we want to vote our own shares, or we give them a menu of options and they direct us. And so we have been, until now, really unable to offer that to individuals. But as we get better data and information, we're able to expand choices to our clients.
So there's so many things to unpack with that. There's been a lot of pushback to the concept of indexing generally as, well, look at it, it's BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street. They control almost, you know, X percent of the market, and therefore they're running the world and we should break this up. It seems to be a fundamental misunderstanding of who owns this stock and what the role of the big index providers and big ETF providers are in this space. You're owning these shares not on behalf of you or Larry Fink or BlackRock. You're owning these on behalf of millions of investors.
Yeah, you're spot on. So the number one misunderstanding is who owns them. We are a fiduciary. The investors own those stocks. And then beyond that, it's more of a regulatory and technology problem to fix. The regulations say that the asset manager votes the shares. And so what we started to do in our institutional accounts, where regulation permitted it, it was just technology and operations, mm-hmm. was to create a program of voting choice that other asset managers actually then went and copied to say to institutions, let's separate the two. And if you want to vote your shares, go ahead and vote your shares. But it's been much harder to do that for individual investors. So being able to take a first step towards that is really exciting progress.
I kind of feel like I'm cheating, like I brought in a ringer, because this is just an exercise in confirmation bias for me.
Well, you're
because,
welcome.
Because, you know, it's, you know, I have read over the years that indexing is un-American, it's Marxist, it's a communist plot, there's going to be price fixing, just every crazy theory that you could come up with as to why indexing is so bad. And when you trace these arguments back, they invariably are coming back to people who are the ones who are losing market share to indexing. And it's hard to have a legitimate discussion where, hey, you know, you're talking your book. And again, full disclosure for both of us, I'm talking my book because I'm a big believer in indexers. But you guys, of the $10 trillion you have in assets, how much of this is indexed and how much of this is more active management?
Well, remember, even within the index category, it's becoming increasingly active. So there are index strategies that take a lot of design principles around how to algorithmically provide a strategy, right? And those are like everything, as we talked about, these active risk benchmarks, anything beyond market cap weighted. But also, importantly, in 2023 in the United States, 25% of new money going into ETFs was in active ETFs. Mm-hmm. So in 2019, actually, the SEC passed a long-awaited ETF rule that made it much easier for any type of asset manager who wanted to distribute their strategy in the ETF wrapper to do so. And there was actually a lot of questioning at the beginning. Well, because ETFs are transparent, would they do that? Would they actually want to have to publish their holdings on a daily basis, or would they resist, thinking that that was giving up some sort of secret sauce? And as it turns out, a lot of managers were comfortable with the transparency. There was some experimentation with non-transparent active ETFs, but as it turns out, I think those were pretty easily reverse engineered. Mm-hmm. So going through the trouble of making it non-transparent didn't help that much, given how much they trade. But investors still want active strategies. The question is that manager delivering alpha or excess return such that the incremental fees justify it? And the transparency of return that traditional ETFs give investors really holds those alpha-seeking managers accountable. But when they can produce it, people will pay for it, and they'll pay for it in an ETF wrapper.
Really interesting.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
So let's talk a little bit about the Bitcoin ETF. What are your thoughts on the process of getting here? What do you think is happening in that space now?
It's been a journey for markets, Barry. I think when I first started getting asked about Bitcoin ETFs, it was about 5 years ago. And when I first heard about Bitcoin, it was probably about 10 years ago. And for us, the question of whether we should provide access to Bitcoin in an ETF is something that came about really in the last few years. There were issuers that filed for Bitcoin ETFs before we did. There were issuers that actually launched futures-based Bitcoin ETFs before we did. And I think that journey for the industry showed us a few things. First, it showed us with respect to the futures ETFs that that wasn't really delivering what investors were looking for, meaning for a whole bunch of reasons, particularly position limits, the futures ETF actually underperformed spot Bitcoin, which is what investors wanted. Now, full disclosure, when I first got asked a few years ago about Bitcoin ETFs, and remember, I am a bond market veteran, so I thought to myself, look, I will come into the office like all day long. I get excited about bringing access and transparency to markets where it didn't exist before. So the high yield market, high yield bond market, for example, that's a no-brainer to put into an ETF wrapper. But to me, it seemed like it was pretty straightforward to just buy some Bitcoin using your mobile phone. And so for us to really be convinced as to the value proposition of an ETF really took hearing from investors, all types of investors, over the subsequent years. And this is what we heard. Number one, we heard they wanted access to Bitcoin. Many of them, for different reasons, were interested in it as kind of an emerging asset class. They wanted some access. And they were trying to get access in a variety of ways, none of which were fully satisfying, whether they were buying it in a trust structure where they didn't have a lot of liquidity and high fees, if they were buying a futures-based product, which really wasn't delivering Bitcoin, if they were buying actual Bitcoin, they were having to deal with a whole new set of infrastructure and pipes and custody questions that weren't transparent and hard to understand.
Passwords and anti-hacking. And what's easier than an ETF, and what could be harder than buying Bitcoin for the average mom and pop investor? It seems like a natural marriage.
And we heard from advisors too, who were getting asked by their clients, and they wanted to provide whole portfolio solutions to their clients. So I think we really became convinced, first of all, that investors wanted access, and second, that the ETF would actually provide a better access path than was currently available out there in the market.
Why do you think it took so long for this ETF to get over the finish line? I mean, the SEC has been talking about this and having hearings and listening to investor input on this. It seems like it's been years, 5 years.
Well, first, I think the narrative from investors really grew over the past few years. The infrastructure in the crypto world was also evolving, but regulation and policy has been evolving as well and still has a long ways to go. So I think regulators needed to, and the SEC in particular, needed to hear from investors, needed to work through the operating model. And then also remember, I mean, you and I have talked about what the past 3 years have looked like. This SEC has a very ambitious equity market structure agenda on their plate, and that's really been their priority. But I think ultimately, investor demand and desire for access in an ETF won out.
I never had any doubt that it would eventually happen. I just had no idea if it was this decade, next decade. But I'm curious as to your experience, what was it like going through the process of applying for approval? BlackRock is such a giant participant in the market. I have to imagine that you were one of the key firms the SEC was consulting with about things like security and password protection and anti-hacking issues and all the custody issues that go with that. What was it like processing the, oh, here's a new ETF application. We're just going to sneak this in with a big pile of other ETFs.
Look, I think for all types of ETFs, as we talked about, it takes an ecosystem to make them work. Given our experience as a markets risk manager in all types of markets, we engage frequently with all types of regulators who are a key part of the ecosystem on how things are working with our observations around ETFs, around markets, around trading, and around liquidity. So with respect to the SEC, our engagement was much less about the if and much more about the how. Here are the ways to provide robust and resilient access to investors in an ETF.
So you guys came out much less expensive than just about every other provider. Where do you think the Bitcoin ETF can go? Can this scale up to something along the sizes of any sort of large index, or is this going to be a little niche product?
I don't know yet, Barry. I'm definitely curious your thoughts on that as well. We know that there was demand for access. We know that there were and are a lot of holders in Bitcoin in vehicles that investors view as less preferable to the ETFs that are now out there. So in terms of the flows that we're seeing, unclear, is that net new demand? Is that just wrapper switching demand?
For sure.
So I think this is like early stages of how the story is going to play out. I would say, by the way, though, I think we're kind of middle of the pack when we think about what investors will look for in terms of costs of an ETF. We really encourage people to look at what we call total cost of ownership, which is not just the expense ratio, but the liquidity, the spread, the access on exchange, the resilience of the operating model. So all of those things contribute to total cost of ownership, which isn't necessarily all captured by the expense ratio.
So there's so many different ways to go with that. First, there's some crazy stat 20-25% of all Bitcoin ever mined
is lost.
Has been lost, right? The password's lost, the hard drive's lost. So I think people, especially Main Street investors, are looking for a familiar name. BlackRock clearly is that. The other thing is all of the interim solutions that have come out, you described that as wrapper migration. I have to think that the futures Bitcoin products are all going to move to ETFs along with the various trusts and mutual funds. It seems this is the ideal structure to put that in. Other than that, I have no guess as to where this. If you were to tell me 5 years from now it's $100 billion, I would shrug. And if you said, oh, you know, never really caught on, it's just a couple of billion dollars, maybe I'm more surprised by that outcome, but it's certainly in the range of possibilities. It could be a giant smash. It could be pretty good. Or maybe it goes nowhere. It's hard to judge. If you're decentralizing finance, if that narrative about crypto is we're going to take finance away from the big banks, well, then the whole concept of an ETF doesn't make any sense.
Right, exactly. That was initially what we thought when people approached us. Like, there were a lot. We
DeFi.
Got so many calls from, you know, various crypto players who wanted us to list an ETF. And the question we asked, the first question I asked was, why do you even want this? Isn't the whole point like disintermediation, DeFi? Like, I'm pretty CeFi with this with this, you know, ETF wrapper thing going. But I guess, you know, as it turns out, it really is that desire by investors for whole portfolio risk management. So for me, I guess I think about what is the best long-term outcome for investors, and it's probably an integration of these ecosystems as opposed to them living separately so that you can manage risk holistically. But like you, we need to see how it plays out.
And the other thing that is obvious in hindsight, the whole concept of trustless transactions where you don't need to have a trust relationship with the opposite party. How has that worked out? We've seen all the big crypto exchanges implode. It seems there's just between the criminals and the blackmailers and the, you know, just crazy run of crypto criminals. Doing it yourself seems so fraught with risk. But if I could say to BlackRock, hey, I'm going to outsource all of my risk management to you, take care of the custody, take care of the passwords, I don't want to deal with any of this stuff, it just seems to be so much easier. I guess it's laziness. I want the most friction-free approach to making a purchase, and I don't want to have to engrave a password that's 97 letters long on a piece of metal and bury it in my backyard. That doesn't appeal to me. So what are you hearing from others in the space in terms of what they're looking for in a crypto ETF?
The convenience of ETFs is incredibly compelling for investors. They understand the ecosystem. Now, importantly, with the Bitcoin ETFs, the institutional grade custody is really important for investors as well. Now, you know, to your question about the crypto ecosystem separate from ETFs, I think there's a lot of questions there around how that evolves in terms of what we've seen so far. Is it the technology that's created it, or is it really the fact that there have been no guardrails around the ecosystem that is built around it? I would say the technology has a lot of promise in terms of its transparency and auditability. This is a technology that presumably could actually decrease the utility for illicit finance. However, we would really need a regulatory and policy environment supporting it. And I think that's where there's a lot of questions, particularly in the U.S., around future direction.
So we have a Bitcoin ETF. What about other coins like Ethereum?
We'll have to watch this space. I think there's really, with respect to what we hear from investors, there's one other coin right now, and then a whole lot of coins that we'll just call them altcoins.
Right.
But the question as to whether investors are interested in an Ethereum ETF, yes, we're definitely hearing that they are. I think we're early days of Bitcoin ETF trading. There's a lot of, you know, policy and regulator change that will probably happen in 2024. We'll have to see what happens from here.
And the BlackRock iShares Bitcoin ETF is iBit, right?
That's the
stock symbol. What have the asset flows looked like? Where is this? Is this thought of as a successful launch? Where have you gone so far in assets under management there?
So iBit is a little bit over $5 billion in assets.
That's pretty quick to $5 billion considering how new this is.
It is. And remember this dynamic that we talked about with respect to wrapper switching. So we do know that there were a lot of, you know, Bitcoin holders that were in wrappers that they felt were less convenient, less transparent, maybe didn't offer them the same sort of, you know, custody that they have. And also maybe holders who are also interested in being able to lend out ETF shares, where it was harder to deploy securities lending type trading in underlying cryptos. So I think this question that we were talking about before in terms of where does the long-term demand come out, it really depends on how investors and how advisors think about this in the context of portfolio allocation.
So I'm going to assume BlackRock doesn't take Bitcoin, or do you? If a client calls up and says, hey, I have $1 million at my BitX custodian and I want to transfer it into an ETF, is that something a broker can do, a custodian can do, or are we not quite at that point yet?
Oh, we are absolutely holding crypto on behalf of our clients in these ETFs. I would think of it very similarly to gold, where an investor who buys our gold ETF or our silver ETF, we have a custodian who is storing silver bars or gold bars in their vault physically. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing in Bitcoin. So we work with a custodian who is storing the actual Bitcoin for our investors in cold storage. And on a daily basis, we are sweeping actual coin into that cold storage. And that custody and the fact that they are actually owning the crypto, that's an important part of the value proposition.
That's really interesting. Since all Bitcoins are created equal, I assume, it's not like this fund manager or that stock screener or that index. At a certain point, it has to come down to cost. Given your guys' expertise, scale, the ability to drive costs down. Is this just going to become a race to the bottom in terms of fees, or how do you see this evolving over time?
Investors care about total cost of ownership, Barry, as we were talking about
before. So it's not just the fee, it's everything else that's involved with it.
It's the liquidity. It's the on-exchange access. It's the diversity of the counterparty ecosystem. All of these things you can measure broadly in thinking about market quality. Is there an options ecosystem on the ETF? And importantly, the operating model matters as well. How is the custody working? Is it, you know, institutional grade custody? And if you really want to get into the details, you will start to see differences in some of the operating models, as you would with commodity ETFs as well.
So it's not strictly going to be a competition based on fees. There are other factors there. Because you guys have the ability to dominate in terms of fees versus smaller competitors. You know, my instinct is, oh, we can dominate this market share by just undercutting everybody else. It sounds like you're taking a more holistic approach than that.
We do take a more holistic approach, and I think that's what investors ask us for. We're certainly seeing this in the fixed income ETF complex, particularly in Treasury ETFs, where there's been a lot of interest and attention lately in the longer part of the curve. And what you will see is ETFs that have much more liquidity. Options ecosystems will actually maintain higher price points, but from an investor's experience perspective, probably a lower total cost of ownership, and they're bigger.
Interesting. I haven't seen a whole lot of marketing for iBit. In fact, I haven't seen a whole lot of marketing for many Bitcoin ETFs, although they're starting to bubble up online. Is this a product that requires a lot of marketing muscle, or is this something that, hey, if you want to buy a Bitcoin ETF, you know where to go find one?
This is a product that was launched in answer to investor demand for access. So it really is a journey of education in terms of what access we're providing, and for investors who want to learn more, not just about Bitcoin, but also it's an opportunity to teach investors about ETFs, to get them to participate in a markets ecosystem that allows them to get diversified exposures across lots of different types of asset classes. So for us, it's an opportunity to talk about access to markets in a broader way, and that's exciting. It's going to bring us the next, you know, 100 million of savers into equity and bond markets.
And this is still really very early days, right? When did the iBit come out?
Second week of January.
I read somewhere you were like the fourth or fifth largest flows for Bitcoin ETFs. Without doing a whole lot of marketing, what does that say about where investors want to manage their risk, who they're comfortable with, who they're familiar with?
I think that looking at the Bitcoin ETF flows, you do have to be very sensitive to the wrapper switching dynamics and what's driving it right
but
now.
But you weren't were you running a futures Bitcoin ETF?
No, we weren't running a futures Bitcoin ETF.
So it's not
Bitcoin
like
ETF.
It was coming from internally. This is flows from outside.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. No, when I say wrapper switching, I'm talking about all different types of wrapper switching, whether it's from a trust, whether it's from a futures ETF, or whether it's somebody who is holding Bitcoin who actually, you know, would prefer to hold their Bitcoin in an ETF because they're worried about losing their key or whatever it is for
it
the reasons
that
we talked about.
It seems much more secure way to do it.
So we were talking earlier, Barry, about flow and tell. What do you read into from flows? Mm-hmm. So the point that I'm just making here is a month in, it's a little early to extract anything about demand for Bitcoin. It's very clear what investors are saying about ETFs and their desire to manage whole portfolio risk and the convenience of the wrapper. For the exposures that they want, the ETF is the first choice. And I think you're going to have to just have me back in a couple of years to see what the Bitcoin journey is.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, and I'm going to say what you're not saying. We already know Vanguard came out and they said they're not going to do it. State Street seems to be lagging. I can easily see BlackRock being the dominant Bitcoin ETF 12, 18 months from now, especially because you don't have those internal flows that some of your Bitcoin competitors do, and you're still kicking butt. So I'm being complimentary and you're kind of being coy about it. And I understand what your corporate charge is, but I think it's a really fascinating story, and it's going to be interesting to watch what happens with Ethereum. But really, it's come down to a couple of coins that serve slightly different technological purposes, and then the rest of the technology around it. It feels like we've been talking about a Bitcoin ETF for years and years, and now it's here. And $5 billion in a month is, you know, just kind of bonkers.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Let's leave the iBit story behind and jump to my favorite questions that I get to ask all of my guests, starting with, what are you streaming these days? Tell us what you're watching or listening to.
I know you always ask this, Barry. So here's the secret with me and podcasts. I do listen to them. I'm not a regular on any. My trick is that if there's a topic I want to learn about or a person that I'm interested in, I search for that and just listen to recent podcasts. So I've been interested in hearing how people are covering Bitcoin ETFs. And I also actually currently am listening to a podcast with a woman named Randy Braun, who we are having speak at BlackRock, but she just wrote the new playbook for women at work. And I'm excited to meet her. I'll be interviewing her. So that's how I listen to podcasts.
Mm-hmm. What about Netflix, Amazon Prime, anything like that?
So my husband is the curator of family shows, and right now he's going through like a zombie series phase.
Okay.
So I don't have a current show that I'm super excited
about. Not a zombie
about.
Fan? Not a big zombie fan?
I'm not a big zombie fan, Barry. Yeah.
Everybody talked about Walking Dead, and it's not what I want to see.
I loved
to relax.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
But that's a whole first of all, it's got an element of humor and wit in it. It inverts the whole model of instead of the pretty cheerleader being killed by the monster, it's a
exactly.
It turns it on its head and she's the vampire slayer. From its inception, it has a certain snarky knowingness that I just didn't pick up in The Walking Dead. The Walking Dead was just a gore fest.
Barry, I'm really happy to hear you're a Buffy fan.
I'm a big sci-fi geek, so
me too.
And it's always funny when you discover people that you would never in a million years guess are like deep sci-fi nerds. So it kind of comes with the math territory. There's a big, you know, the Venn diagram has a big overlap with that. I'm still have an image in my mind of, I don't remember if it was the series or the movie, where it's Pee Wee Herman at the end, where he's impaled on the stake, and the death scene of him just going, just slowly dying. It like that sort of hilarious parody of the genre. If you're a film buff or a sci-fi, you have to really appreciate that.
It's just classic.
Most people, you know, don't make movies that way, but it's really interesting. I don't remember if last time we spoke about my two favorite streaming sci-fi recommendations.
I don't think so.
So one is Altered Carbon, which is this short two-season series that if you're like a hardcore sci-fi geek,
okay,
it's amazing.
I've heard of it.
And then second, on Amazon Prime, was The Expanse, which is insane and just, it morphs over time and goes in all sorts of crazy places, but the universe it creates that's not a million years in the future, it's not radical technology. It's far enough in the future that people live on the moon, people live in Mars, people live out in the, work in the asteroid belt, and they live out on, I think, Titan, one of the moons of Jupiter. And then what are the geopolitics of the Belters, the Earthers, and the Martians? So the technology is close enough to today that it's very believable, and the world that it creates is just, it's completely mayhem. Really, really fascinating. You don't have to build weapons. If you have the ability to just heave asteroids towards your enemy, it's just wild. So it definitely takes a couple of wacky turns in the latter seasons, but the whole ride is, if you're a sci-fi geek, you may appreciate it.
On my list.
Let's talk about your mentors who helped shape your career.
My earliest mentors were actually in theater. I had my first real backstage experience being a stage manager. The head of the drama department reached out to me. He wrote me a note afterwards, and he let me follow him everywhere and just taught me a lot. But he wrote me a note that said, and I kept this note for years, it said, "You've got what it takes, Samara. Thanks for sharing it with us." And I remember I saved that note. And even when I was doing things that had nothing to do with theater, it gave me a lot of confidence. So I would say that was kind of my first real mentorship experience.
You mentioned some books earlier. Let's talk about some of your favorites and what you're reading now.
Well, now that you said the sci-fi thing, I will share my favorite book that I read in 23. I don't know if you read this. It was called Cloud Cuckoo Land, which is a really cool book. It's, I think, 6 or 7 different intertwined stories that range from ancient Greece to sometime in the future. But it's a story about hope and resilience and space and time and connections. And I thought it was just gorgeously written. And I read a lot of fiction and I like things that just kind of expand how I think about the world. So I would definitely recommend Cloud Cuckoo Land. And then I'm also a markets history nerd, and I always will be. So I am reading right now The Bitcoin Standard, which is less about Bitcoin, I think, and more about the history of money and the ways civilizations have sought to find different ways to transfer value across space, across time. That's fascinating to me, and I think really instructive in thinking about the future of markets.
Did you happen to read either of the two big crypto Sam Bankman-Fried FTX books, either Going Infinite or Number Go Up? They're both delightful in different ways. Number Goes Up is a little more horrifying because you see the seedy underworld of how criminals and human traffickers use Bitcoin, use all sorts of crypto. But it's really a great work of journalism and revealing. And Going Infinite, anything Michael Lewis writes is always going to be delightful. So our last two questions. What sort of advice would you give a recent college grad interested in a career in investing, ETFs, indexing, any of the work you do at BlackRock?
If they are interested, my advice would be to go for it. I talk to a lot of college grads who are wondering, will I be good at this? Should I try it? And look, I had a theater background and I gave it a shot. There are so many different ways to be successful in investing in markets. And I've heard people say, you know your strengths and lean into your strengths. And sure, that's true in the long term. But I think college and learning, and again, I'm saying this as a parent of teens, it's about uncovering your passions and leaning into those. You have no idea what you're going to be good at until you try. So if you are interested in investing and in markets, there's so many different jobs and types of ways to get involved, whether it's at an asset manager or a trading firm or a broker dealer or a wealth manager. So get your foot in the door. Start to see if it is, you know, what you want it to be.
And finally, what do you know about the world of investing today you wish you knew 30 years or so ago when you were first getting started?
The moments that feel the worst in markets, the scariest, the most volatile, are the moments where you can define the outcomes that you're delivering investors and define your career. I look across my career at these moments that I thought, oh my gosh, we never thought, you know, this sort of flash crash, this sort of dislocation, this sort of black swan event would happen. But over the course of a 30-year career, which I've had, there have been many of those. And what we learn in those moments, how we stay close in those moments, manage risk for investors, and what we learn coming out of them are the biggest contributions we can make from a portfolio perspective and I think from a markets perspective. So it would have been interesting to have been told that on my first day of work, which was about 30 years ago.
I love that answer. I have a vivid recollection in the middle of the financial crisis of saying to one of the traders, a line from Apocalypse Now, the Duvall character, you know, someday this war is going to end. he says with a bit of longing and bittersweet recognition that it's a unique moment in time, and drink it all in because you're not going to see anything like this again. And I think people sometimes don't appreciate that, at least in the mayhem of the moment.
Exactly.
Really fascinating take on this. Samara, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with Samara Cohn. She is Chief Investment Officer of ETF and Index Investments for BlackRock. If you enjoy this conversation, check out any of the 500 previous discussions we've had over the past 10 years. You can find those at iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get your favorite podcast. Check out my new podcast, At the Money, short 10-minute conversations with experts about issues that matter deeply for your earning, spending, and most importantly, investing money. At the Money, wherever you find your favorite podcasts, and in the Masters and Business feed. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team that helps us put these conversations together. Paris Wald is my producer. Juan Torres is my audio engineer. Sean Russo is my researcher. Atika Valbrun is my project manager. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.